So, good morning. It's good to be here with you today. And on Friday night, for those who can remember back that far before the auction, we had the Jackson Interfaith Peacekeepers annual convocation with Bishop Gumbleton speaking. I asked him a question about the social gospel and how he handles criticism, and that led him to comment on how he believes you can't talk about the sorts of things we were talking about that night from the pulpit, things like state-sponsored terrorism and, well, becoming a nation of peace. It was a moment of irony for me because, of course, we talk about peace issues and anti-war issues all the time in this church. Our Unitarian Universalist Service Committee declared this year's Justice Sunday to be on the theme, the cost of the war in Iraq, and John Hart led a service on that back a couple of months ago. For me, preaching on social justice themes is easy. What's harder is giving the sort of sermon I'm giving today, both because it's very personal and because it touches on tricky theological boundaries in a way that could be just as controversial as war to some people. And so, I have given this sermon that you're hearing today twice already in different UU churches in order to have the time to work out the kinks and also the time to work up my nerve. Another major difference, though, between our tradition and Bishop Gumbleton's that was very evident to me in his response was the tradition we have of the free church. He spoke of his audience at church as a captive audience. And I think that, in a way, that's true for him, but in a way that's not true for us. First of all, we don't tell you that you're going to hell if you go to another church and stop going to this one. I've never heard anyone say, well, you can go to another church, but you'll be going to hell if you don't go to the Unitarian Universalist Church. But more than that, I really don't think of you as a captive audience. This isn't the captive church. This is the free church. And part of that freedom is freedom of the pulpit, where I have in my letter of covenant with you that I can speak my truth without fear of censor. But you have a corresponding freedom of the pew. You can believe anything I say or not at will. You can choose not to come. You are not expected to believe the things I say without testing it with your own reason and logic. And so, with that in mind, let me tell you my story. For a long time, I considered myself a humanist and an agnostic. And I want to begin by saying I still do. But what I want to share today is a very personal story about several experiences which made me realize that I had been limiting my understanding based on childish views of God. So as I said, I consider myself a humanist and an agnostic. But I do, every so often, pray to God. I've called it keeping the lines of communication open, just in case he's up there. So about 4.5 years ago, I said a prayer that has become a memorable and some would say mystical experience for me. And I've mentioned it a little before to you. I was at a UU camp in New England, Roe Camp, and I went on a walk to find a goddess statue that I had heard about. And I had the idea that I would climb into her lap, and it would be oh so spiritual, and I would say a prayer there. And when I got there, her lap was small, and she wasn't the goddess image I had pictured, and her lap was full of snow and leaves and mud anyway. I looked at her and said, I don't think so. And I turned around and I walked back. Halfway down to camp, I realized that I hadn't said my prayer while I was up there. And so I stopped and decided to pray. And I put my hand against a large tree, and I looked up, and I said in my customary way, Dear God, if you're up there. And I prayed, and I asked to be able to have a child. And I said my amen, and I stepped back, and I promptly fell to the earth. I felt like I had been pushed to the earth, and it seemed like it was a response to my prayer at the time. What did it mean? My first thoughts were that it was definitely negative. I thought maybe God was saying I was praying the wrong way, or that the answer was no, but I wasn't sure what it meant. And eventually I figured out that it didn't mean no to my prayer because I did have a child. But 4 years later, I finally figured out what the prayer meant and what the response meant. It took a trip across the world, a walk in a labyrinth, coming back, waiting a few months, another walk in a labyrinth, and a conversation with a friend to figure it out. I was being dope-slapped by the goddess. Some would say literally. I don't mean it literally, but let me explain. Ultimately, as I said, the answer couldn't have been a simple no, since I did have a child, but I was worried about that up until her birth. But after Katie was born, I put that experience behind me, and I stopped really thinking about that prayer and that moment at Roe Camp. It was just one of those things, one of those indescribable, inexplicable moments, and it had no real impact on my theology. So last June, I went to Transylvania for a conference for women ministers. I wear this stole in memory of them today because they all signed it at the end of that week together. It was a group of American Unitarian Universalist, Transylvanian and British Unitarian, Dutch Remonstrant, and a couple of Hungarian Reform women ministers. And one of the things we did was walk in the labyrinth that was marked out on the floor with rope in the same room that we worshipped in. We did different exercises, such as walking in silence, walking while singing, dancing through the labyrinth. Every morning and every evening, there was also a dancing time where we did these sort of spiritual circle dances. My back was not so much up to the dancing. And so I often did a couple and then sat out. One day, near the end, I decided that while everybody else was dancing the circle dance, I was going to walk the labyrinth. I knew that the previous day, the whole group had walked the labyrinth while asking a specific question as they walked. I had missed that exercise, since I had gone out with my sister's mother-in-law, who lives in Koloșvar, Romania, to see the town. So I walked the labyrinth while the dancing was going on, and with each step, I said a word of my question, rhythmically, over and over again, until I got to the center. And the question I asked was, is there a God? Is there a God? Is there a God? And as a background, I should say that periodically for the last 25 years or more, I have prayed a prayer to God, asking if God was there to give me some sort of sign, help me to believe, and I have never gotten that sign. But as I say, I try to keep the channels of communication open. So I walked the labyrinth, and I was completely absorbed in my question, in the rhythm of my question and my footsteps. The rest of the room with the dancing blurred out. And I got to the center of the labyrinth, paused, still asking my question, is there a God? Is there a God? Turned around, walked out, still asking my question. As I got to the end, stretching, the room and the dancers came back into view. And all the women were singing. And the song that they were singing was, Ancient Mother, I hear you calling. Ancient Mother, I hear your song. I realized it was an answer of sorts. And I had been asking, once again, the wrong question. I had long ago rejected my childhood image of God, the God who answers petitionary prayers, plays favorites in football games, saves some children and not others. I had long ago rejected the idea that there was an old man with a beard in the sky who looks down and watches and listens and reaches down and stirs things up every so often. But I had been continuing, whenever I prayed, to pray to that God. Even though I've studied theology, and I've preached on the subject, and I've led classes and written about feminist theology in particular, and explored pagan ritual, even though I've done all those things, when I was praying, I was back in my childhood concept of prayer, doing that same kind of Our Father who art in heaven kind of prayer. Sometimes our childhood views of God are hard to let go of. Other times we rebel against that concept and we don't replace it with anything else. I have broken down the theology, deconstructed the idea of God and patriarchy, but I have never reconstructed. Specifically, I have often said, I don't know if there is a God, but I do have very specific ideas of what God is like if there is a God. And I had said this, and I had believed it, and I still believe that that's true. But what I haven't done is reconstructed my prayer, my ritual, my prayer life, based on that understanding of theology. I was still doing petitionary prayer, waiting for the literal, concrete answer from God. So I went on a minister's retreat this past October at the Grailville Retreat Center. It's a Catholic retreat center in Loveland, Ohio, that our UU ministers chapter meets at every year. It was also the site, coincidentally, of the first conference for women ministers in our denomination, across our denomination. And they have a labyrinth in the back of the building I was staying in. The paths are dirt paths dug in the tall grass, and I decided that I needed to walk the labyrinth again. So it was hot, and I carried my water bottle. It's a sermon prop, you see. And I decided to walk the labyrinth singing that song that I had heard as the women singing as I had exited the labyrinth in Pennsylvania. Ancient mother, I hear you calling. Ancient mother, I hear your song. Despite the water bottle in my hands, I held my hands in ritual position, palms down for walking in, letting go of things, palms up, walking out, receiving wisdom. Shifting my water bottle around to do that. I walked the labyrinth while singing, stopping every so often for a swig of water. And I wasn't watching my feet the whole time. I almost stepped on a field mouse. He scurried away just in time to let me avoid his tail. I saw a snake at one point, too, I think, out of my peripheral vision. The bugs and the butterflies were all around. The grass was tall. I was sweating in the sun. I kept singing very softly, almost like breathing, and my breath got harder and I got warmer. And I got to the center, paused a moment in reflection, and then started out, still singing. And as I came out, it came to me that I had been looking up and looking around. And this labyrinth was calling me to look to the earth, to pay attention to the ground, to feel my connection to the world around me. All my sweat, my breathlessness, the field mouse, the butterflies, they were all telling me that I am part of the earth. It is a part of me. The connection to the ancient mother, the way to hear her calling, was not formal prayer or meditation, but living itself. And I thought back, and I put this together with a conversation I had had with a friend a week or two before, and it all came together. Shortly before I went to Grailville, I had lunch with my friend Amina. Amina had recently stopped wearing the hijab, the head veil commonly worn by Muslim women. She had undergone a spiritual transformation of sorts, and she realized that the hijab represented dogma, and she no longer needed dogma to be faithful. I had had conversations before with her about the hijab, and she had said, as I had heard other Muslim women say, that it isn't restrictive or oppressive, and that it's a choice. But she had realized that that choice could also mean not wearing it. So she came out from behind the veil, and it was interesting to hear her say her experience of what it was like after so many years of wearing it, to take it off and to hear her community's reaction. And in the course of this conversation, I felt she would be a sympathetic person for me to talk to about what I was experiencing, because I realized that I, too, was undergoing a spiritual transformation that was making me realize what I had been doing was all about dogma and that I didn't need that dogma anymore. She had cast off the veil. I was casting off my childhood rituals related to a childhood view of God. I talked with her about what I was processing from Transylvania and how I realized that when I had prayed to God in the past, I prayed to exactly that sort of God that I knew was not true, even in my agnosticism, that I knew I didn't believe in. I don't believe that God or the goddess answers petitionary prayer. With both sides of that football team praying so hard, no game would ever end. And I don't believe in a god or goddess who interferes in human existence that way. Yet this was still the same way I'd been praying to God. And when I prayed to God, I was praying to that same sort of Sistine Chapel old father God that I preached against. And so when I asked, is there a God? And I heard, ancient mother, I hear you calling. It was telling me the prayer isn't supposed to be about me asking God or the goddess. Prayer is supposed to be about me listening. And that listening isn't going to be, that my answer isn't going to be given in the form of a direct call. I already knew enough to know that. The song was saying, I do hear the calling, even though it isn't literally God saying, Cindy, I want you to build me an ark. In the course of that conversation, I realized that, of course, calling doesn't mean that. And of course I do feel called. And I still don't know, after all this, for sure, if there is a god or goddess or not, but I do know that it was time for me to revisit my understanding again, and specifically my ritual life, and also, though, my understanding of calling and the vocation. What I believe, which is to say, not what I know, but what I think holds true for me, is that if there is a god or goddess, these words refer more to energy and connection than to a personality or figurehead. God or goddess is something that we and the world create together. And I started using the term goddess rather than God, not because I see God as inherently gendered. The Venus of Willendorf is no more my idea of the image of God than is the God on the Sistine Chapel. I say goddess now because it helps me remember that this is not the image. It is still easy to think I mean something different by God, but when using that word, to slip back into the same old patterns. The same God who roots for sides in a football team, in a football game. And so what I experienced that might be termed God or goddess has come to me through symbols, images, connections that are traditionally termed feminine and are associated with feminist theology, like the labyrinth or the image of the earth or Gaia or the web woven by grandmother spider. And what I know about prayer, or to say what I believe about prayer, is that prayer isn't me talking, me asking for things, or even asking for a connection to God. Prayer, I've learned, at least for me, in my understanding, is about listening. And what it's about specifically listening for is listening for an understanding of my connection to the earth, to each of you, to society, to all living things. It's about listening for my calling or vocation. What is it that I am meant to do? By which I mean not, again, that God will call me up and say, Cindy, I want you to build me an ark. It should measure this many cubits long by this many wide and this many deep. Rather, it is a way of knowing when I am on my path because I am in balance, what the Taoists might call harmony with the Tao. I've known this for a long time. I've been talking about what my spiritual model is for 7 years and more, and I take my model from my mentor, Drew Kennedy, the minister in Milwaukee at the UU Church there, and he talks about spiritual practice as being in right relationship, and that this right relationship functions at many levels, personal, societal, and environmental, and so on, cosmic. He outlines this in an article in the book Everyday Spiritual Practice. So, in a nutshell, the idea is that one should be in right relationship first with oneself, knowing yourself and having integrity, next one's family and close circle of friends, neighbors, co-workers, fellow churchgoers, and then be in right relationship with all of society and then the earth and all its creatures to walk lightly across her back, and finally to be in right relationship with the cosmos or god or goddess. So abstractly, I've known that I had this model. But what I hadn't known until these walks in the labyrinth was that I wasn't living it. I wasn't living my spirituality. I was still living that spiritual practice I had been taught as a child. Preachers learn to preach their message, but sometimes we, or at least I, can forget to live it and practice it. It's easy, as I said in the beginning, to preach social justice because I know I try to live that to the best of my ability. It's harder to preach spirituality because I hadn't been living my spiritual beliefs, at least in what I knew to be true. And each of us must find that balance, that harmony with the Tao of knowing and doing in order to be on our spiritual path. And perhaps I finally am.